we all have the same words at our disposal, a dictionary full of them, but it takes a poet to spin them into gold.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
You unlock this door with the key of imagination. Beyond it is another dimension. A dimension of sound, a dimension of sight, a dimension of mind. You're moving into a land of both shadow and substance, of things and ideas. You've just crossed over into...
Stick anything into the fog, y'all. Make it look like a ghost. But tonight, let's not become tragedies. We are not funeral homes with propane tanks in our windows looking like cemeteries. Cemeteries are just the earth's way of not letting go. Let go. Tonight, poets, let's turn our wrists so far backwards, the razor blades and our pencil tips can't get a good angle on all that beauty inside. Step into this with your airplane parts. Move forward and repeat after me with your heart.
Repeat after me with your heart.
I no longer need you to fuck me as hard as I hated myself. Make love to me. Like you know I am better than the worst thing I ever did. Go slow. I'm new to this, but I have seen nearly every city from a rooftop without jumping. I have realized that the moon did not have to be full for us to love it, that we are not tragedies stranded here beneath it, that if our hearts really broke every time we fell from love, I'd be able to offer you confetti by now. But hearts don't break, y'all. They bruise and get better. We were never tragedies. We were emergencies. You call 911. Tell them I'm having a fantastic time.
Tell them I'm having a fantastic time.
Go on. We did it.
Why don't you live so God can use you any way, oh glory time? Why don't you live so God can use you any way, oh glory time?
You are about to hear the actual voices of some of America's great poets, past and present. The voices of Walt Whitman and James Whitcomb Riley to the voices of Robert Frost and William Carlos Williams.
You are listening to Yesterday, Today, and Tomorrow, a transcribed feature of the NBC News and Special Events Department. This week, Our subject is American poets. And now to introduce you to some of the great American poets of the past and present, here is Leon Pearson.
The United States, best known for power and progress in material things, has also brought to the world a fresh and stimulating idea of what poetry can be and how close it can come to being a part of our lives. Whitman did this as a pioneer, and Sandburg and Masters and Frost and now Williams, yes, and many others. They revolted from the idea that poetry must deal with ancient and classical themes. Whitman, addressing himself to the muse, said, "Come, muse, migrate from Greece and Ionia." And again he said, "Placard removed and to let on the rocks of your snowy Parnassus. For know a better, fresher, busier sphere, a wider, untried domain awaits, demands you." And the muse has answered. Answered with what is perhaps the one supreme contribution of American poetry to the literature of our times. Finding beauty in simple things and expressing it in free and unfettered forms.
I painted this on canvas before I wrote it. I soaked it in your dreams and stroked it into a masterpiece. And after each moment, I pointed back at the canvas like, this looks beautiful, don't it? Lord, it can't be done in finger paint or watercolors. It has to be done in acrylic. The message has to be textured so even when you feel stressed, you could feel it. And any layer that's not perfect, I'll peel it and repaint. I need it to be in sync with the movement of your colors, baby. I am not like any other. I will hold you in a perfect light like this easel, and perhaps you believe trusting your life to an artist is unreasonable, but I don't even need you to actually love me. I only need you to really believe you do. And trust. I will use this brush like blush. My foundation is far realer than concealer. My touch will line your eyes, and ain't no need for mascara when you're in the presence of a healer. I will make you the darling of exhibits and the constant conversation of art critics, and all I ask is that you bring your true self whenever you pay my studio a visit. Baby, this is bigger than the Mona Lisa. Honestly, you should only be painted in murals. Baby, this is bigger than American dollars. Honestly, I chose to buy all these art supplies in euros. You are so gorgeous that viewings of your likeness should only be accompanied by an orchestra and a chorus and rose petals on the floor with cases of the finest wine before it. And all I ask is that you allow me to use these words to paint your essence while you sit back and relax comfortably in my presence and enjoy it.
What we have of Whitman today is not so remarkable for what it says as for the fact that the words are spoken in Whitman's own voice. This is a recording made in 1890 on one of the earliest cylindrical gramophones. This is the only known recording of Whitman's voice obtained from the remarkable Roscoe Haley collection in New York. When it first came to us, this recording was battered and almost unintelligible. Our engineers went to work on it with filters and other electronic devices and have restored it enough to bring out the earnest tones of Whitman's voice. It was not possible to eliminate from the background the whir of the old cylinder, but the voice rises clearly above that. For the greater clarity, let me give you first the words that Whitman speaks from his short poem, America. Strong, ample, fair, enduring, capable, rich, perennial with the earth, with freedom, law, and love. Now, Walt Whitman.
America, center of equal daughters, equal sons, all alike and good. Grow, ungrow, young or old, strong, ample, fair, enduring, capable, rich, perennial with the earth, with freedom, law, and love.
The America Whitman was writing about has come a long way since then. And stands today the greatest power on earth with responsibilities and taxes never known before. Whitman seemed to foresee this before the turn of the century when he wrote these words. It all seems as if the Almighty God had spread before this nation charts of imperial destinies dazzling as the sun, but behold the cost. If you would have greatness, know that you must pay for it with a proportionate price.
Life is a drug, then I've been taking some hard hits. Like, I'm trying to see how intense the sense of humor of God gets. But I'm dedicated, because I know spoken word can make the living come alive. And if I'm involved, We're going to require at least 5 30-plus single black mothers. Otherwise, it could be pointless. Because if this is God's work and the man on the microphone is anointed, then if you provide him with the conditions he requires, he might be able to use his art to make your heart drop into your lap. Move this room into a whole nother world. Take all them young cats that just came here to mingle and say something to make their brains tingle without drug the first. Because this is that spoken love that hurts. Every phrase is tasered to make your blood feel electric. But you can't just take a hit. The hit's got to take. This is that spoken word where you've got to swallow the smoke from the words. Open up your mind and let your brain float from the words. Think of something in your life you want to change and gain hope from the words. Because that's how the living come alive. And this is that bona fide. I made it with the dust off of old 78s and 45s. Codified it in the spoken word. Digitized it into ones and zeros and MP3'd it for your iPod. Heavy underground like the Earth's core. The crowd recognized the underground heavy from the tat that he wore. Allow me to introduce that energy that only inner God can produce. Come to spoken word, get your inner God seduced. Because what else can move your inner self outside yourself like the truth? But that's how the living come alive. And if you don't know what a juke joint is, there's a very good chance you ain't gonna understand what the point is. But this is underground. So they can't convince me to call myself Black Teed and show up to the mic every night wearing this black tee because my style ain't so earthy, it's so unlike Black Tee. You might need to bring a mason jar of corn liquor with you. Pop off the lid, take a hard twig, let that corn liquor hit you. At the end of the night, meet us at the bar, cop yourself a large snifter. That's if you with the Mr. Picture this. Gordon Parks, James Van Der Zee. It's all right when I'm on the mic if you want to close your eyes and breathe life into your fantasy. But remember, ain't nobody here but me and you right now. And ain't no coincidences, I was sent here for you right now. To tell you, if you want to change your life, you better make it do whatever you want it to do right now. But I hope you want more from life than money, because money ain't hard to come by if money is the only thing that you absolutely care about. But you should know that life is just preparation for something more majestic. And spoken word is just life when it's presented at its most expressive. And the reason why poetry ain't bigger in this society is because this society is oppressive. And every oppressor since the dawn of time has tried to dead whatever art form made the living come alive.
But strong and clear is the voice of Edwin Markham reading his best known poem, the poem which made him famous, The Man with the Hoe. This is a more recent recording, and it brings out sharply the Western twang of his voice, and also the emphasis with which he bears down on the social injustice that he saw in looking into Millet's painting, the work that inspired the poem.
The man with the hoe, bowed by the weight of centuries, he leans upon his hoe and gazes on the ground. The emptiness of ages in his face, and on his back, the burden of the world. Who made him dead to rapture and despair, a thing that grieves not and that never hopes? Stolid and stunned, a brother to the ox. Who loosened and let down this brutal jaw? Whose was the hand that slanted back this brow? Whose breath blew out the light within this brain? Is this the thing the Lord God made and gave to have dominion over sea and land? To trace the stars and search the heavens for power? To feel the passion of eternity? Is this the dream he dreamed, who shaped the suns and marked their ways upon the ancient deep? Down all the caverns of hell to their last gulf, there is no shape more terrible than this, more tongue with cries against the world's blind greed, more filled with signs and portents for the soul, more packed with danger to the universe. What gulfs between him and the seraphim? Slave of the wheel of labor, What to him are Plato and the swing of Pleiades? What the long reaches of the peaks of song, the rift of dawn, the reddening of the rose? Through this dread shape, the suffering ages look.
It's metaphysical. And the only thing that most of us know about metaphysics is the question, if a tree falls in the woods and there's no one there to hear it, does it make a sound? And the funny thing about metaphysics is that the most quoted person is an 18th century German philosopher named Dr. Kant. And what's so funny about that is that there's people in our community who practice metaphysics without knowing it, and still their favorite word is Kant. And they have a similar question. Namely, if a man has a child and he doesn't do anything to help support it, does it really exist? And he can't see that you can't be a man if you don't face your responsibilities. Ain't no justification for not taking care of your children, no matter how you feel about the mother talking about that bitch. But if this ain't bitch but holes and tricks, and all you do is hoe and trick, then what does that make you? See, I ain't got no deadbeat friends, because I know a man who got his own child's back and never have my back in the end. Besides, what makes him think that he could stand in the same room with men? Why face your fears? Stay home, play PlayStation, drink beers. I hope you choke on 40 ounces of your children's tears. You think this is happy that your baby's mom's got a new man to get help pay for your kids? Name one thing more important to do with your money than take care of your child. But instead, you'd rather play predator and take some prospect out, knowing your baby's mom should just come up from behind with a baseball bat, and as soon as you lean back, just crack the fucking steak out your mouth. You're a child in a man's body. First loser want to buy a round of drinks at the party. Feeling generous, are we? What you should be feeling is sorry. And it doesn't even occur that now you're forcing your mother to watch you do the same thing to another woman that your father did to her. But I know you can't afford child support. Where a real man would rather work four jobs and see his children starve, you just lay around talking about what you can't handle. But then again, for you, I guess it's good that your children don't metaphysically exist, because that way you can justify not being a man, can't you?
And now to Dr. William Carlos Williams.
Many, many poets have talked about being lonely.
I think the artist, generally speaking, feels lonely. Perhaps his very recourse to art in any form comes from his essential loneliness. He is usually in rebellion against the world. I think that's a rule. I have thought myself that that's a rather a snide thing to say. Here I'm living with my wife and child and saying I'm lonely. It merely records a fact.
Yes, but you, more than most artists, are also living in a community and doing a job in a community.
Yes, it's true. But if you do your job, you're most lonely, strange as it may seem, because in your ordinary work, and there's your incentive for art all the way through, you yourself, as a man, as a woman, as an individual, are very seldom completely involved in your own work. And that answers, to some extent, the question, how do you find time for writing? It's a necessity, because the essential I, the person himself, does his work, but remains, after the work is finished, there he stays, like a man who arrives at the age of 65 and retires, or is retired by his firm, and when he gets all through, he finds that he doesn't exist and never has existed, poor guy. He never knew it before. He thought that the job was everything in his life. Well, he's finished. He's absolutely finished. He goes out and shoots himself very often. There is nothing left of him. And I wanted to make very sure that that was not going to happen to me, baby. No, sir.
And I hold her naked body firmly in my hand. And I close my eyes tightly. And I slowly bring her whole closer to my lips. And I could be killed for what I'm thinking. It's beyond human experience. I could be killed for what I'm thinking, drinking cyanide in my dreams. It seems that I'm moving past my past, past elementary school days, past K to the 12th grade, where everybody knew that Boogie Down Productions would always get paid.
in full like Rakim, at least until black radio forgot him. Went rock bottom, fell 12 levels below Sodom. Sold out, well all the white national radio conglomerates got him strung out. Like my old high school friend who used to wear 3 different leather suits a day and push the dime pieces in the jet black Benz. At least until he saw half his life end getting shot down on the roof of the projects. Now he just shoots up on the roof of the projects. And yet, even he has a longer life expectancy than me, cause I could be killed for what I'm thinking. And I let her hole sit completely on my tongue, and I'm just dying for her to come. I want her whole nine to just ejaculate straight through my mind. I want her to come so hard that she blows off my headpiece so that I might finally have peace in my head. But instead I hear a million ancestors yell that I have no right to have no life. They tell me I am exactly what comes after the ones that survived the middle passage. They tell me I am directly descended from the ones who thought it was punkish to jump ship. The ones who mastered their masters, those angels, those gods who worked hellishly hard from can't see to can't see in a plantation, slaving for the very same Satan that they created. They grafted their own masters. And every night, a million bodies, blacker than cooked soot on the bottom of a crack pipe in a dark corner of the basement of a crack house, when the moon signals midnight, sing to me. They sing that I am the ungrateful realization of their dreams. They sing that I am their socio-technologically spoiled offspring. They sing, since it took 400 years of misery to bring me here, my suicide is not an acceptable offering. They sing that I was expressly put on this planet to speak dynamite to granite. That I was intended to spit tears into microphones so that billions of disenfranchised black children might find their way back home. And I cry cause I am ashamed that I could be killed for what I'm thinking. And I want her to come so bad, but I manage. I want her to come so bad, but I manage. I want her to come for me so bad, but I manage to pull the gun off of my tongue, turn my thoughts indivisibly in the direction of black youth, and behold, ejaculating out of my throat is the truth.
I believe certain things. I feel that certain things, disastrous things, are happening in the world because of man's stupidity, definite stupidity. I can't do anything about it. Personally, either as a physician or as a citizen, I can do very little but vote. Which is a mechanical gesture of some value, of course, I acknowledge it, and I always vote. But in my mind, I've so far gone beyond any of the formal pretexts of politics, whether I'm entirely right or not is another thing, that they seem old hat, most of it. I mean, humanly, they are. Every man of any sense knows that the brutality of the world, it has to be outgrown, that's all. And we outgrow it in our art, in the technique of our art, in the way the line is put down, in the way the colors are applied. I think that the artist really, basically, within himself, is always among the most advanced men of any period. They are the ones who symbolize their thought in their works, and so are always laughed at, inevitably, too, because our first reaction is laughter to anything we don't know, laughter or murderous designs. The artist is way ahead of his age in his general thought, and so is lonely. Lonely. That's where the loneliness comes from.
Well, if I could bring another man's work into this
yes?
for a minute.
I have a
poem here by Archibald MacLeish that I came across the other day that is kind of relevant.
Yes.
Do you know his Invocation to the Social Muse?
I just know the name.
Well, he speaks here of this very thing, and then his final question is it just to demand of us also to bear arms, speaking of the poet?
Yes. Well, I'd answer the question by saying we must bear arms. In one book of poems called The Tempers, I say that the writing of the poem is part of the war. I'm not anxious to rush off and bear arms, but if I should be asked to bear arms, I would do it gladly, and I'd probably be a good soldier, because I know that I am, after all, one microscopic person. No matter what I may think, or no matter whether I believe that I'm doing something valuable or not. And I think a proper citizen of any country or any group should submit himself to the rule of the group in an emergency. I think there are reasons why we should rebel at times and voice it and go down without a murmur. I don't believe in trying to escape it or lying or cheating or trying to subvert the government by falsity. That I would absolutely oppose in anything. Come out straight, face it, and stand up and get it in the face and say, thank you, sir. Go ahead and shoot me. I'm much obliged. But that's what I think a man is, and I think a poet belongs there.
I want to tell you about some blues I got one time in a little place called Vietnam. Now, I guess Vietnam's about as far away from here as you can get, because it didn't seem to matter which way the jet flew. Sometimes we'd go east, sometimes west, but no matter, 22 hours later, there you are in Vietnam. Now, I did 3 tours over there, 26 months, in which time I came down with malaria 3 times, jungle rot, immersion foot, 2 kinds of internal parasites, shrapnel wound in my leg, and Agent Orange all over my body. I'm talking blues now, Jack. Well, you run into 2 kinds of Vietnam combat veterans. Some can't talk about it, some can't stop. But there's one thing we've all got in common. Sometimes we get thinking of the guys and gals that didn't make it back, and we come down with a real bad case of the Vietnam blues.
I wonder if we could get to your poetry again now.
Yes.
Some questions. Let's take just a simple little poem about the plums.
It's curious how a thing of this sort, which was really just a passing gesture, it actually took place just as it says here. And my wife being out, I left a note for her just that way. And she replied very beautifully, "Unfortunately, I've lost it." I think what she wrote was quite as good as this. A little more complex, but quite as good. This, perhaps the virtue of this is its simplicity. Well, let's have it then. This is just to say, I have eaten the plums that were in the icebox and which you were probably saving for breakfast. Forgive me. They were delicious, so sweet and so cold.
Now, what I want to ask you about that...
What makes that a poem?
In the first place, it's metrically absolutely regular. This is just to say, I've eaten the plums that were in the icebox and which you were probably saving for breakfast. Forgive me, they were delicious, so sweet and so cold. So, dogmatically speaking, it has to be a poem because it goes that way, don't you see?
Well, this goes against so many preconceived ideas of poems, though, because it's the kind of thing that almost anybody might say.
Yes. Because no one believes that poetry can exist in his own life. That's one of our immediate fallacies, that nothing... Some Englishman said, imagine reading a poem in the American dialect. How impossible. Well, that's the first hazard. That's the first hurdle. We have to get over that. That it has nothing to do with the way it's said. Oh, we have something to do because it can be badly read and otherwise. But we can't believe that we poor colonials, as we have been ever since the revolution, we poor people who are not living in the great centers of Europe could have anything happen in our lives important enough to be put down in words and given a form. But everything in our lives, if it's sufficiently authentic to our lives and touches us deeply enough with a certain amount of feeling, is capable of being organized into a form which can be a poem. In fact, those simple difficulties, those things which are at the base of all the English departments and all the universities in the world and make them all asinine because they're usually 20 years back at the times, are the things that make it impossible to hear a poem. Like, we can't even hear it anymore because we don't believe it can happen in our lives, our own lives, you know, as if we were Greeks who've been dead 2,000 years. We're not yet dead, most of us. Some are living on, quite dead. But you have to get used to the fact that in your own life, that which touches you, such as your affection for your wife, I think that's material for a poem. That's really a definite poem without even writing it. But then if you can give it conventional metrical form, why, my God, you're just simply superb, that's all. You've done a great deed.
You should know that they couldn't create a mirror that could begin to show you half the things that I see in you. Because more important than your face and your shape, I'm in love with the woman you're becoming. And I can foresee a day where your hair is mostly gray and your smile shows intense living. And no one can look in your eyes without seeing decades of wisdom. And I'm not concerned with the woman of the year because I'm in love with the bride of a lifetime. And I don't want to watch your figure. I'd rather watch you use your left and right mind. And I'm in love with your laugh more than the tightness of your abs. And though a mirror can show you your present, I'm obsessed with our future and our past. And my love lasts because it has the benefit of knowing that to truly be intimate, I don't focus on the qualities you have now. Instead, I focus on the qualities you have that are infinite. And that should be the sentiment that takes us all around the world to ocean liners and beaches and hotels and far reaches where we'll use stolen glances to communicate our secrets. And I hope our love is the one that teaches couples how to share their lives and men not to compare their wives with what seems greener on the other side. And I'll confide in you nightly, then provide for you daily, then in between do the best that I can to treat my fellow man fairly. But it's most important that I be that eternal flame that brings you heat whenever you're cold. And you'll always see yourself clearer in me than any mirror, because I'm a pure reflection of your soul.
Find one of your poems there that has a lot of good American in it.
Well,
something that you...
Let me see. Let's take Old Bunk's Band.
Fine.
Old Bunk, you see, the theory is that you can make a poem out of anything. You don't have to have conventionally poetic material. Anything that is felt, and that is felt deeply, or deeply enough, or even that gives amusement, is material for art. This is Old Bunk's Band. These are men. The gaunt, unforesold, the vocal, blatant, stand up, stand up. The slap of a bass string, pick-ping, the horn, the hollow horn, long drawn out, a hound deep tone. Choking, choking, while the treble reed races alone, ripples, screams, slow to fast, to second to first. These are men. Drum, 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 drum. The ancient cry, escaping crapulence, eats through, transcendent, torn, tears, term, town, tense, turns, and backs off whole, leaps up, stomps down, rips through. These are men, beneath whose force the melody limps, to proclaim, proclaims, run, and lie down, and slow measures to rest, and not never need no more. These are men, men.
We were born, so there's that. and it wasn't a tragedy. Everybody was really excited about that miracle of life that happens every 11 seconds. Remember? Everybody was just so stoked. Maybe you don't remember, fair enough. But the reality is, in the law of nature, we were all born. That's why we're here. If there's any philosophy majors in the room, fuck off. On the other end of the spectrum, in the law of nature, there's death. That's the exciting part. It's learning how to live for a living. There's the tricky bitch. But ultimately, once we rise above it, death is no tragedy. Yes, especially if you're in it right now, I'm not here to demean or diminish the valid grieving process you're going through. But I am saying that the ego attaches such amounts of weight and position to those we lose. But ultimately, death is not a tragedy, and it's not a surprise. Ever since we got here and we could comprehend it, we've all known it's going to happen to every last one of us. And so what I would like to encourage you all to do tonight, besides participating more in your existence, is also to participate a little bit more in psychological evolution and stop making everything such a goddamn tragedy. For instance, you don't have to wait for Katrina to happen to go check in on your neighbor. In between the born part and the death part, it's something else that happens, that pursuit for life and love and happiness and joy, a sustainable joy, a warmth, not the desperate burning thing you've been mistaking for love, but a true warmth. And in that, oftentimes what happens, and somebody in the room is bound to be going through it right now just by odds. Oh, thanks for waiting to come back till I'm done. Is that sometimes one person loves another person and it's not reciprocated. And the person who loves the most feels like they're at the mercy of the person who loves the least. And it may cause them to sit on the edge of their bed for weeks or even months at a time with the wind knocked out of their heart, not knowing what to do with that rejection, the knife fight in their ego. And it's quite a thing to contend with indeed. And the last time I was in it, somebody said to me, forgive and forget. And I remember that while I find that to be a fantastic concept, I had no idea how to implement it, and it only served to piss me off. Forgive and forget. If you're in it tonight, if you're in the sticky tar pit of it, the part where it's been consuming you for a long time and you don't know how to get it out from your vision, I just want to ask you if you would. I know there's nothing I can do to say anything to solve it or take that away for you, but I would just like to ask you to make it have a seat next to you for about 4 minutes and just be with us right here and don't let it consume you right now. Give me 3 or 4 minutes because I want to talk about forgiveness. And what I want to say is this, it's that if we were created in God's image, then when God was a child, he smushed fire ants with his fingertips and avoided tough questions. There are ways around being the go-to person, everybody, even for ourselves, even when the answer is clear. Like the holy water Gentiles would drink before they realized. Forgiveness is the release of all hope for a better past. I thought those were chime shells in your pocket, so I chucked a quarter at it, hoping to hear some part of you respond on a high note. You acted like I was hurling crowbirds at mockingbirds and abandoned me for not making sense. Evidently, I don't experience things as rationally as you do. For example, man, I know mercy when I have enough money to change the jukebox at a gay bar. Somebody's got to change that. You know mercy whenever someone shoves a stick of morphine straight up into your heart. It felt amazing the days you were happy to see me. So I smashed a beehive against the ocean to try and make our splash last longer. Remember all the honey? Had me looking like a jellyfish, ain't for you. You walked off the water in a porcupine of light. Strands of gold drizzled out to the tips of your wasps. This, it's an apology letter to the both of us for how long it took me to let things go. It was not my intention to make such a production of the emptiness between us, playing tuba on the tombstone of a soprano to try and keep some dead singer's perspective alive. It's just that I could have swore you sung me a love song back then, and that you meant it. But I guess some people just chew with their mouth open. Wow. So I ate earplugs alive with my throat, hoping that you'd get lodged deep enough inside the empty spots that I wouldn't have to hear you leaving, so I wouldn't have to listen to my heart keep saying, all my eggs were in a basket of red flags, all my eyes to a bucket of blindfolds, in the cupboard with the muzzles and the guns. You know, I didn't mean to speak so far out and off, trying to drive your nickels to a well when you were happy to let them wishes drop, but I still show up for gentleman practice in the company of lead dancers, hoping their grace will get stuck in my shoes. Is that a handsome shadow on my breath, sweet woman? Or is it a cattle call in a school of fists? Don't dance with me. Less like a waltz for panic and more for the way we hoped to swing the night we took off everything and we were swinging for the fences. Don't hold it against my love, you know I want to breathe deeper than this. I didn't mean to look so serious. Didn't mean to act like a filthy floor. Didn't mean to turn us both into some cutting board, but there were knives stuck in the words where I came from. Too much time in the back of my words. I pulled knives from my back and my words. I cut trombones from the moment you slipped away. You don't know it left me looking like a knife fight. Lady boy, I know it left me feeling like a shotgun shell. You know, I know I might have gone and lost my breath. But I want to show you how I found my breath to death. It was buried under all the wind instruments, hidden in your castanets. God damn, if you ever want to know how it felt when you left, if you ever want to come inside, just knock on the spot where I finally press stop. Playing musical chairs with your exit signs. I'm gonna cause you a miracle when you see the way I kept God's image alive. If I really was created in God's image, then when God was a boy, he wanted to grow up to be a man, a good man. And when God was a man, a good man, he started telling the truth in order to get honest responses. He'd say, yeah. I know. I really should have worn my cross for you. Again. But I don't want to scare the Gentiles off. That's not what I came here to do. I'm pretty sure I came here to love you.
How does it affect you when you read a poem that you've forgotten? Is it like reading something written by someone else?
Well, this time I was just faking it because, for the purposes of continuity, I had to read this poem, but I hadn't read it for some time, and I left out a verse, and I've forgotten the meaning of the whole poem.
Does this in any way disturb you? Isn't every poem a part of you as a poet?
Well, it doesn't disturb me because I don't think anything was at stake, but I think that the message comes through, you know, with the body. With the eyes and the voice, you could really be reading the instructions from a shoe polish can.
What's the point of writing poetry then, if you could just as well read instructions on how to polish your shoes?
Well, it depends. You know, if you want shiny shoes, then you want to. If you want people to have shiny shoes, you want to write those kind of very good instructions. And if you want to polish other parts of yourself, you do it with poetry.
How can you relate the writing or the creating of a work of art with an act of polishing shoes?
Well, I don't know. It depends how far you're looking. You know, it depends exactly where you've got your binoculars trained. If you stand far enough away, it's probably the same thing. You know the story of that juggler who performed his acrobatics and plate balancing in front of a statue of the Virgin? Well, I think it really comes down to that. You really do what sings.
Is that the key to your diversity?
Well, I'm all in one place.
Well, I don't know. You're, you may seem so to yourself, but you must admit that for other people looking at you, Leonard Cohen, the poet, the novelist, the man who lives in a White House on the island of Hedra, scion of a Jewish family from Montreal, pop singer and writer of pop songs. All these things, they may certainly add up to Leonard Cohen, but they do look rather complex at first.
Well, I think that, the borders have faded. between a lot of endeavors, and people are no longer, I think, capable of those kind of poses, like the poet, you know, on the mountain with the cape, and or the singer, you know, sort of catering to the masses. All those kinds of expression, I think, are completely meaningless. They don't mean anything to me. It's just a matter of what your hand falls on. And if you can make what your hand falls on sing, then you can just do it. I mean, if someone offered me a building to design now, I'd take it up. If someone offered me a small country to govern, I'd take it. You know, anything going, I'd like to try.
Does the fact that maybe the building you designed would fall down, or the country that you were trying to govern would turn into chaos, have anything, you know,
no,
would you feel badly about this?
Well, I don't think the building would fall down, and I have a, you know, I have a, perhaps a, an arrogant dream that the country would, well, I knew a fellow who was trying to take over a country. He's a friend of mine in England. He's the head of a large Negro movement there. And he will probably take over a country soon. And I asked him, you know, what the purpose of his government will be. And he said, well, it will be to protect the people from government, you know, because they're just fine as they are. Just let them alone, and my government will just keep everything away. And I really think that things are a lot more substantial than we think. And I think that my building would probably last... Well, it would be the kind of building that that was either designed to last or fall down, depending on the needs of the people who live inside. I mean, some people may want a building to collapse over them at a specific time. A friend of mine designed a mural for a coffee shop in Montreal with a special glue on it. And this glue dried every winter, and the mural fell to pieces. And he had to be engaged every winter to repair the mural. And he said, you know, cars are designed with built-in obsolescence. Why not murals?
What about poetry?
Well, I think that history and time pretty well builds obsolescence into poetry, unless it's really the great stuff. And you never know whether you're really hitting that.
Don't you ever?
Sometimes you know about it. Sometimes it has a kind of ring. But I'm not interested in posterity, which is a kind of, as somebody said, a kind of paltry form of eternity. You know, I'd really like to write poetry. I like to see the headlines, you know, like instead of the Spencer case, something like Town Finishes Painting Today. You know, I'd like the stuff I do to have that kind of horizontal immediacy rather than something that is going to be around for a long time. I'm not interested in an insurance plan for my work.
What about the kind of diversity that you want to do? Do you want to write musical comedies like Harold Town wants you to?
Oh, yes, sure. I'd like to write a musical comedy.
What would it be about?
I really don't know. That would really have to, I really have to fall on an idea and turn it out. But I'd like to do that. Maybe Town would sing the lead.
Does he sing?
All the time.
Does he?
Yeah, he's a very good singer.
Do you mean with notes and everything?
Well, he's not tied down to anything.
Does that help to sing?
I think it helps everything.
Does that mean you have to opt out of society? It's a terrible phrase, but it's the only way I know how to put it to you.
Well, it's a good trick if you can manage, but I don't know anybody who's managed to do that. Everybody's in here. Everybody's on the crust of this star, and I don't know. I don't know anybody who's opting out except a couple of astronauts. And they always come back, and they bring their own smoked meat sandwiches with them. I mean, nobody really wants to leave.
When you go off to your house in Hedra, do you want to leave? Do you leave things behind?
Well, I have no plans to go back there. I've been in Greece off and on for 6 years now, and I don't know, I've just been discovering Toronto for the past couple of days. It's really, really nice.
Is it exciting?
Yeah, well, you know, I think it's a happy revolution.
A revolution?
Well, that's how they describe all phenomena today. But, you know, there's the quiet one in Quebec, and I think there's a happy one here. I was walking on Yorkville, is that the name of the street, and it was jammed with very beautiful, beautiful people last night. And I thought maybe it could spread to the streets next, you know, and maybe even, where's the money district? Bay Street?
K King and Bay.
King and Bay. I thought that maybe they could take that over soon, too.
Those people need the kind of happiness that you can sing about?
Well, I mean, I'm no criterion. I don't establish any of those criteria for happiness, but I just like to sing. Like, I don't have a program to establish with my singing. I just like to get up and sing my piece and sit down, listen to other people.
I suppose you don't make any value judgments either about what you like to do better or less. But right now, you're writing songs.
Yeah.
Well, and you're not writing poetry, and you're not writing a novel at the moment. So you're liking it better.
Well, I've got a new book of poems ready to go out, but I don't want to make people find me oppressive, like glutting the market with my work. So I'm holding that back a while. No, it just everything keeps on going, or it stops. But I mean, you know when you're happy. You know, I think that's. There's been so much talk about the mechanics of happiness, psychiatry and pills and positive thinking and ideology, but I really think that the mechanism is there. All you have to do is get quiet for a moment or two, and you know where you are.
And for this knowing where you are, you don't need the help of anything like drugs or liquor or anything?
Well, it's not a matter of the help. I mean, you can cooperate with the vision that alcohol gives you. You can cooperate with the vision that LSD gives you. I mean, all those things are just made out of plants, and they're there for us, and I think we ought to use them. But also, there's another kind of high to get from refusing to use them. You know, there's all kinds of possibilities. Like asceticism is a nice high, too. Voluptuousness is a high. Alcohol is a high. A town gets beautiful under alcohol. I get just kind of stupid and generally throw up. But some people get really beautiful with alcohol.
Do you see things in terms of highs and lows? Or is this just an appeal to sensation?
Well, it's not just a matter of sensation. What I mean by high is not a manic phase of swinging, knocking down buildings and laughing hysterically. I mean that you're situated somehow. There's a nice balance, you know, that you're in the center of your own orbit. Or as Dylan said, you fade into your own parade.
Hey, Mr. Tambourine Man, play a song for me. I'm not sleepy, and there is no place I'm going to. Hey, Mr. Tambourine Man, play a song for me. In the jingle jangle morning, I come following you. Though I know that evening's empire has returned into sand, vanished from my hand, left me blindly here to stand, but still not sleeping. My weariness amazes me, I am branded on my feet. I have no one to meet, and the ancient empty streets too dead for dreaming. Hey, Mr. Tambourine Man, play a song for me. I'm not sleepy, and there is no place I'm going to. Hey, Mr. Tambourine Man, play a song for me. In the jingle jangle morning, I come following you. Take me on a trip upon your magic swirling ship. My senses have been stripped. My hands can't feel to grip. My toes too numb to step. Wait only for my boot heels to be wandering. I'm to go anywhere, I'm ready for to fade into my own parade. Cast your dance and spill my way, I promise to the wonder is. Hey, Mr. Tambourine Man, play a song for me. I'm not sleepy, and there is no place I'm going to. Hey, Mr. Tambourine Man, play a song for me. In a jingle jangle morning, I come following you. Though you might hear laughing, spinning, swinging madly across the sun, it's not aimed at anyone. It's just escaping on the run. And but for the sky, there are no fences facing. And if you hear vague traces of skipping reels of rhyme to your tambourine in time, it's just a ragged clown behind. I wouldn't pay it any mind. It's just a shadow you're seeing that he's chasing. Hey, Mr. Tambourine Man, play a song for me. I'm not sleepy and there is no place I'm going to. Hey, Mr. Tambourine Man, play a song for me. In the jingle-jangle morning, I come following you. Take me disappearing through the smoke rings of my mind, down the foggy ruins of time, far past the frozen leaves, the haunted, frightened trees, out to the windy beach, far from the twisted reach of crazy sorrow. Yes, to dance beneath the diamond sky with one hand waving free, silhouetted by the sea, circled by the circus sands, with all memory and fate driven deep beneath the waves. Let me forget about today until tomorrow. Hey, Mr. Tambourine Man, play a song for me. I'm not sleepy and there is no place I'm going to. Hey, Mr. Tambourine Man, play a song for me. In the jingle-jangle morning, I come following you.
Very powerful stuff. What more do you want?
I am always there. So when you get tired of listening to fake players, I am there for your CD player. Play a track, bring it back to something relevant, because real men move with intelligence, and the down presser don't tell me what to say, and I figure if a man is scared to die, he's already dead anyway. So imagine me supporting some villain who gets funded millions to jump in my system and start peeling caps at my children. Soon as I turn a beat on, he trying to beat on my woman. Every line is rhyme designed to prevent my son from becoming a man. He want him to die by 25, see his father bopping to the beat, shed a tear, wonder why I would support some disgrace just because he got jewels glued to his face, when putting material possessions over the love of our community is how we became slaves in the first place. But I am always there. Always shining, ain't no diamonds necessary. When I'm gone, I want "he was a man" to be the only sentence printed on my obituary. Incendiary against cats who don't make sense, cause I figure they're against my community. Do what his master says in order to get paid in cars and jewelry. Then can't come out on the block unless he got at least 50 cops. And if I can't leave my home, what the fuck do I need with a platinum watch? But watch me, I'm always there. Round the clock, phone call away. If your name come out somebody's mouth, they better be careful what they about to say, cause that's me, eyes glaring, nose flaring, staring, daring somebody to come test. By your side, do or die, I mean no require bulletproof vest. Treat your children like my own. Something happened to you, I got them today grown. No matter where you walking by yourself, believe me, God, you ain't never alone, cause I am always there. I represent you from the boardroom to the street. I only care about two things, that's my principles and making sure our family eat. And don't you worry about his numbers, cause at most he got like two or three summers, and after that it's back to flash and crack like he's some old broke ass plumber. But believe, I got you from below zero to 130 degrees. My love don't cease. Your enemies are my enemies, and you ain't never had a friend like me. I am always there.
Now, go find the others. .com.
I need to say my poem. I went trespassing in the forest. Fishy, fishy jumps.
Dead monkey peeped the rhino, and I had to bounce. Old hot dogs are juicy enough to drink. I love these beans. Destroy the mysteries and then go fight Chewbacca.
Well, that was conceptually adventurous.